Welcome to Faithful Economy, a podcast of the Association of Christian Economists. We host conversations about important economic and moral questions. I'm your host, Steve McMullen of Hope College. This week, I talk with Scott Cunningham about markets for prostitution and his book on causal inference. Scott is a thoughtful scholar working at the cutting edge of empirical microeconomics. He's a professor of economics at Baylor University, research fellow at the Texas Hunger Initiative, and at the Computational Justice Lab. He's also an associate editor of the Journal of Human Resources and co-editor of the Oxford Handbook on Economics of Prostitution. And as we discussed, the author of the forthcoming Causal Inference, the Mixtape, from Yale University Press. Our conversation covers his research on the changing technology of prostitution markets, the difficulty regulating these markets, and some discussion about what a Christian response should look like. This conversation was really interesting, but the topic is a challenging one for me. As you will see, Scott has grown through his research to have a real concern for the well-being of those at the margins of society. He does not find it easy to apply strict legal sanctions to prostitution, even if he believes that the practice is immoral. I think there's a deep conversation to be had about traditional sanctions on prostitution, and I don't think I end up totally agreeing with him. Even so, I came out of this discussion thinking a lot more deeply about these issues than I had before. I expect you will too. Matt Cunningham, welcome to the podcast. It's really good to see you.
Nice to see you in person, Steve.
Hey, you have made a bit of a name for yourself by doing a whole bunch of different kinds of research that's both cutting edge and really interesting topics that are not the norm. So let's just start right there. You've researched drugs, sex, video games, abortion. I love to use your papers in class because students are immediately drawn to the topics, but also, you know, the writing and the empirical research is well done. Talk to me about why you're drawn to these topics, how you got into this line of research, and what keeps you doing it.
You know, I think I'm probably drawn to this research because I'm kind of an unconventional economist even before starting the program. I was actually an English major, and in college, just spent most of my time reading theology and philosophy. And so I just really was not interested in economics. I didn't know anything about economics. So, to say I wasn't interested isn't fair. I just didn't know anything about it. But I just was really interested in, I come from a Calvinist background. And so the biblical world life view was always really a big part of my background. And so I always thought about everything being, worth studying and stuff like that. When I graduated from college, I got a job in market research and was doing qualitative research and didn't have a background in social science. So I was just trying to get up to speed on all this stuff I didn't know. Stumbled across Gary Becker's Nobel Prize speech and the economic way of looking at life. And it really captivated me. I think there was a few things. I was just interested in human behavior, like at a real basic level. Why do people do the things they do, as opposed to something very special like, why do commodity prices, really important things, but those weren't really, like all that captivating to me. They were too esoteric. And so I was really intrigued by this idea that economics with these kind of simple frameworks of, optimization, equilibrium, marginalism, that and stable preferences, and this like that idea that could go a long way in explaining behavior. So that kind of excited me. And when I saw what Becker studied, crime, the family, racial discrimination, it was immediately the stuff I wanted to study. I didn't want to do sociology. I think part of the problem was in my literature programs, it was a very Marxist guided kind of program. And it kind of turned me off to, I sort of had a bias against Marxism. And so when I would read sociologists, it just seemed like I was going to have to go back into this sort of environment that I found, like that brought out this defensiveness in me. And so I was really attracted to this idea that, economics allegedly was like value neutral. That's obviously not true, but like it seemed like it was something I could manage a little better. When I got into the program, so I read this paper by David Mustard on gun control.
Yeah.
He was a professor at Georgia So I applied to Georgia and wanted to study with him. Ended up meeting a professor named Chris Cornwell, an econometrician. And I think through that relationship, and probably just that even in our field courses, it became kind of clear I wasn't going to be writing models. You know, in our field courses, the stuff that really I was drawn to was empirical work. And so I decided, you know, since I was weakest in econometrics, but it was going to be my whole life, I needed to make econometrics my field. And so I specialized in econometrics and decided to write a dissertation on marriage markets. And so it was all about mass incarceration and the shortage of Black males that it created, African American males that it created in marriage markets, and how that just, you know, the theory was how that was changing the relationships and the matching between men and women in those communities. And so Chris had always been just very encouraging for me, you know, in the directions that I went, but kind of held me to really high standards empirically, really grounded me, you know, sort of like, you know, these are great ideas, but you're going to have to do an empirical project. So what are you going to do? So through that relationship, you know, I just really was given permission. And when I got my job at Baylor one fall, I got an email from this guy named Todd Kendall, who I had discussed his paper at a conference. He was at Clemson at the time. He said, basically, I found this website where clients will rate prostitutes. And I have the ability, we can write a program that will harvest all the data, which at the time I'd never even heard of people doing that. This is like 07. And so I just sat there, you know, for a week. I, you know, told Todd I'd get back to him. And I could just see when I looked at the data set, like he sent me the data set, or he sent me like a sample of the data set. We were going to have to reharvest it. Yeah. I could see like that this technology was changing relative prices. Like, you know, when you sort of have studied the Chicago economists, they're really big on changes in relative prices and change, you know, they have these really simple models and, you know, but a lot of things come down to like changes in tech in costs. And so, and I've been reading a lot of Al Roth. So I was thinking a lot about search and two-sided matching and platforms. And so that was kind of like swirling in my head, and I was thinking about marriage markets. Yeah. And so, you know, that's essentially how I think about prostitution is marriage markets. Marriage markets are obviously just like a generic term to talk about two-sided matching. It's called a marriage market, and usually the notation is men and women, but it's usually describing firms and workers. And so, you know, I could see like that technology was going to be affecting the probability of getting caught, the amount of time that you spend searching for a person. All this information was there. These men were recording tons and tons of information, and I could get the data. That was kind of the key thing. That's kind of what, you know, I got from Georgia and Chris was, it wasn't enough to have, you know, I'm not Al Roth, so I'm not going to have this theoretical, you know, these theoretical breakthroughs. I'm just an applied person, and I was going to have the, you know, hundreds of thousands of observations on transactions, which, you know, in prostitution, historically, you're talking about dozens of observations, right? It's just it was never a quantitative field. Right. So it was always qualitative. It was always ethnographers. Very, very focused on street prostitution in response to the crack epidemic and the AIDS epidemic. So like it was very narrow in terms of a high risk kind of period of time, like the 80s and the 90s. And so we didn't know a lot. We didn't know anything about the broader market, you know, because those are low risk markets, and you didn't have economists studying it anyway, to be honest. And it is a market. And that's, you know, whereas like there's a lot of things where you could say, well, why would an economist be the one studying, I don't know, it's like something random that seems like why this isn't really in the purview of an economist. A lot of things in health. Prostitution is fundamentally a labor market, you know? I mean, it's got prices, it's got supply and demand, and markets that connect them. And so of course an economist would be studying it, and it's and it hadn't been. So I could see like a theory about how technology was reorganizing the markets, information technology and the platforms. I could get the data. There were other data sets I could get, and I could see like five papers, you know, immediately that I could write. And, you know, I mean, you're trying to get tenure and you need five papers to get tenure. And so I just decided to do that. And along the way, you know, also wrote papers on methamphetamine policy, drug policy, and abortion policy, sort of like had this. And then the video game, there was, you know, there were other things. I just kept studying the stuff that I basically just studied things that I felt like I could understand, you know, like that intuitively I felt like I understood. I mean, it's not that I had a background that would have made me understand sex markets, but my dissertation was on marriage markets and it did get into sexual behavior. Yeah. And I just felt like it wasn't such a deep literature. It felt like it kind of felt like I had a lot of creativity to start brand new, you know? I mean, like I could take this Al Roth framework or this Becker framework, and I'm not really competing with a lot of other prior literature, you know? I mean, so in some ways it felt like it was really perfect for my personality, which is I'm not really the economist that does well writing the 12th minimum wage study. You know, like I'm not, that's like an important part of science, but I'm not really good at it, you know, because it's very tedious and having to interact with all those other people who are really smart. I kind of work better being the first person on something. Or I have, you know, with my empirical background, I have some hook that I think will allow me to have some new insight that others have missed or something like that.
So the Scott Cunningham production function, I guess, would be to find some topic that is undercovered, find some new data, right? And then go for it. I mean, that does
something I'm really passionate about, though. I mean, it's got to be, you know, for me, what works well is a research agenda, you know, like that's what gets me out of bed in the morning. You know, it's harder for me to get out of bed in the morning for a singleton paper that's kind of standalone, that I don't have like a passionate commitment to a broad, you know, series of papers that I think are going to really leave me at the end of it better than I was before. You know, I feel like what was really exciting about prostitution was it had so many moving parts. You know, I mean, immediately, for instance, I fielded a survey of 700 prostitutes, and I got to interview over the phone about two dozen prostitutes. You know, there was an internet survey, but like I also, because I had that qualitative background from market research, I was also doing phone interviews, and that was really important for me. I mean, just to help me feel like I was learning something. It was like the models that I was working with seemed to make sense to the sex worker. You know, I mean, like that was the other thing, was I felt like it was really important to me that the economics of it made sense. And I had to talk to these people to sort of learn a little bit more about signaling and screening and a lot of stuff that economists kind of can take like a blackboard sort of approach, like never talk to a single person and kind of think it's all just in their head. So I mean, it was just really rewarding. And so, you know, my best projects have been ones that are a series of papers, like the meth projects were like that too, and my new mental health care projects are like that.
Let's talk about that. But let me push you a little bit to give us some wisdom about the nature of markets for prostitution.
Yeah.
So if I look at your work overall and just the way you're describing it right here, it sounds like the overarching theme rather simply is just that these markets operate a lot like other markets, even when we might expect them not to.
Right.
So, but that raises a question, though. The way Roth talks about markets that have some kind of cultural taboo, right? He says they operate as a kind of constraint.
Yeah.
What function does that constraint play? Is it primarily demand side? Is it primarily supply side? Or how does it change these markets? Or maybe it doesn't change the way they operate. Can you talk about that?
Well, I mean, in the United States, you know, one of the ways repugnance is what, that's what Roth calls it.
Yeah.
You know, these taboos, he calls it repugnance, which is not technically moral disgust. It seems like repugnance is more moral taboos that lead to bans. You know, that's like the key piece of repugnance is it's not just a psychological opinion or response. It's also a movement towards policy, that it's such a severe, you know, thing that we're going to ban it. And so the thing that happens in the United States is it just drives it. It makes it illegal, punishes it with penalties from the state. These penalties include fines. They include imprisonment and stigma, you know. And so those things are going to have a lot of repercussions for a person's life. They'll, you know, affect employment opportunities, marriage market opportunities, friendship networks, lots of things. So many people end up not participating in the markets because the consequences are so severe. So you end up with markets that historically have a lot of negative selection. You know, I mean, you end up with supply side people who have very little opportunity, who discount stigma intensively. So you end up with these markets that have participants who are probably the worst off. Mm-hmm. You know, and that can, and in many ways, once you're studying a market that is so endogenously shaped by negative selection, and then you draw conclusions from that about how markets function, it can lead to real fallacious conclusions, because much of what you're observing about high risk behavior could very well be because of the prohibitions that led to so much negative selection and removed a lot of mechanisms that are usually used in legal markets to sort of massage out, you know, a lot of high risk behavior, right? So, you know, for instance, the sex workers avoid banks, right? Because they can't account for all the income. Well, so they don't save, you know, they're vulnerable now to being robbed. They might therefore, you know, have, even at the margin, discount rates that shift a little bit towards present consumption. So, you know, there's all kinds of things that could end up just leading to like financial illiteracy that's like might already be there by negative selection, but like gets re-intensified by the market. So you end up with just all sorts of problematic supply side behaviors that I think sometimes the people that want to talk about first order bans aren't really aware of how it ricochets through in like really realistic ways that affect people's lives, you know, and sort of like they kind of take this, and that's what I feel like when I hear these philosophers that talk about, you know, the human body becoming a commodity.
Yeah.
It's like, I just want to know, they make the, you know, I can't argue with those arguments because I don't know. I'm not a philosopher, and I find a lot of it very compelling. But part of me just wants to know, you know, just because that's true doesn't require using the violence of the state to ban and imprison people. You know, I mean, it doesn't necessarily lead to that. And there's all kinds of problems that happen to real people's lives as a result of that. And so, you know, sometimes I guess what has happened is, so yet the taboo part, it affects the supply side, it affects the demand side, as, you know, essentially through costs. You know, people don't want to get caught, they don't participate. Conditional on participating, they, you know, have to work with, because it's illegal, they can't advertise very easily. So they have historically worked with intermediaries. You know, there's lots of ways in which the historical market was shaped by the inability to just publicly advertise. Can't own capital, right? So you can't own a firm. So if you can't own a firm, what are you going to do? So you're going to meet privately with people. You're going to, you know, you may not have security. There's lots of things that can just sort of, you know, once you remove the ability to own capital, you don't have a safe room. So there's all kinds of stuff that has been sort of a big part of my research agenda, both looking at legalization and the internet, which kind of did actually solve some of those problems through just information technology related matching and contracting. A lot of innovative tools that sort of emerged with the internet.
Okay, so I found this really interesting. Assume our listeners here aren't familiar with the research. So talk through the Craigslist research that you've been working on, and particularly how that changed the markets, and then what happened when they shut it down.
Sure. Look, in prostitution with the internet, you know, when you say the internet changed prostitution, like what did it do exactly? What it did was it facilitated matching between buyers and sellers. I mean, so the thing about prostitution, what makes it identical to every legal market is every legal market has buyers and sellers for some particular commodity, milk, for instance. But the problem is, how do you find each other? How do I find a milk vendor, right? I'm willing to pay, you know, above cost for the milk, probably, you know, depending on who the milk vendor is and what his costs are. And he's willing to sell to me his milk in exchange for money. But like, you know, I can't just randomly go up to strangers in the street, right? So what happens is through legal markets, they just emerge, you know, through stores and, you know, there become these platforms, grocery stores, basically platforms matching buyers and sellers. And the shelves become platforms matching buyers and sellers. Prostitution is exactly the same way. There are people who have a willingness to pay for intimacy, sexual intimacy with another person. And it's complicated, okay? Like there's many different reasons for it and many different purposes for it. Some of it's kind of complicated psychological stuff and some of it's hedonistic stuff. Some of it's kind of probably psychological disorders and some of it's loneliness, you know, some of it's dangerous stuff. They want to hurt the person. So, you know, there's all these ranges of reasons that usually a man would be willing to pay some amount. He could translate it into money that he's willing to pay. Some people are willing to pay nothing, negative numbers, but you know, some people are. Then there are, we'll talk about the heterosexual market. There are women, adult women, consensual, voluntary women who are willing to engage in sexual intimacy in exchange for compensation. Like some people, that price might be infinite. You know, they just simply, there is no price that you could pay them that would allow them to do that for psychological and moral reasons. But there are people, you know, a non-trivial number of people who are adults that say they are willing to do it. But they can't just announce in the United States, you know, like in a public square, because they'll be arrested, right? Yeah. So you can't just go up to strange women and make offers, because that's just absolutely offensive. That's the thing. That's the thing about repugnance, right? You could do that with, say, hey, do you know anybody that's selling Girl Scout cookies, right? And you're not going to, and it might be socially awkward, but it's not going to be offensive. But you couldn't do that with drugs and sex work or kidneys or like all kinds of stuff like that are just so profoundly offensive that they'll immediately call the police or punch you in the face or go get their friend to punch you in the face. So, you know, there's a huge wedge in the market. And that's what in illegal markets, whether it's drugs or sex or something else, the whole fundamental problem that has to be solved is that problem of identification. Who are the buyers and who are the sellers? Because once that's solved, then the markets will form endogenously around whatever the solution mechanism is. And so what historically was done was the market was very thin. So like in certain regions, there might be no market because it's not, demand's not large enough, supply's not large enough, for whatever reason, it's just broken. You know, I call it broken. It might be successful from some person's perspective, but like from the perspective of the fact that there are buyers and sellers and they can't find each other, you know, it's broken. But like what was historically done is you would have these intermediaries, you know, like the maitre d', or I don't know, you know, the hotel, you know, person that like had a list of women for VIP clients, or just weird, the limo driver or a pimp or a street, you know, or an escort agency. And so these things were solving that identification problem. What the internet did was it provided a non-intermediary solution to that matching problem through platforms. And it did it through two ways. It did it through classified advertising, and that was Craigslist, and then eventually Backpage, and then kind of eventually like a lot of classified advertising websites. And then it did it through review websites. That was the website that Todd sent me. It was called The Erotic Review, and it was like a Yelp for sex workers. And as we both know, Yelp-style internet feedback is a major part of internet commerce. And so you have these two types of platforms, and they're both solving the search problem.
Now,
because basically what a client can do is just go to those platforms and just search down and in their area clandestinely without ever speaking to an intermediary or going to a street corner, they can find everybody in a region. And every region basically started getting thick. As long it started to thicken.
Now, who's reviewing who in the erotic review? Is it the clients reviewing the prostitutes or the other way around? Or is it both ways?
The clients review the prostitutes. So the platforms that have emerged for the sex worker, those have been a little bit more spotty. Okay. They'll typically circulate lists, like blacklists, whitelists. It's kind of more of a it's organized, but it's not like a true platform, you know, kind of thing. But the Erotic Review has on it a whitelist of clients that have been screened. So there ends up being these two-sided kind of screening that happens. One through they're both reputational screens, but like one is through the platforms that are reviews of the women, and then there's like screening sites that will help a woman screen a client. And what Craigslist did was it provided the classified advertising. So like prior to Craigslist, there just was nothing. There was websites and very, very expensive advertising websites, but there wasn't free advertising. There was like in things like the Village Voice and Providence Phoenix, these like alternative newspapers, in the back of those newspapers, there was like erotic kind of advertisements for spas and things like that. But, you know, those weren't in every market, and they ran for like a month and they were expensive. The thing about Craigslist, it was updated constantly. You know, it was free. You had photographs. You could write whatever you wanted to. So it was, you know, kind of this like typical thing you hear about the internet. It's kind of like a democratizing of market because it was just free. Because, you know, what was Craigslist trying to do? Craigslist was trying to destroy print media advertising. They were trying to just capture the whole market. A lot of their site was free. They just charged for housing and for jobs. So when they came in, I mean, you can see it in some of the, you know, I've seen it in one alternative newspaper, the Providence Phoenix. When Craigslist entered Rhode Island, I mean, it just decimated the Providence Phoenix. I've spoken to the CEO of the Providence Phoenix. He just said they were just hemorrhaging once Craigslist came in because everybody stopped buying ads, you know? I mean, so that's kind of like, it's kind of interesting. I mean, like part of the prostitution story is that print media decimation of print media revenue that's coming from the like this essentially low cost firm. I mean, Craigslist has like 10 employees, you know, it's very, very inexpensive, low overhead. Every website's identical to another.
Talk about the effects then. So how does this impact the sex workers? So they have access now to, they don't have to go through a middleman. They can advertise services for free.
Yeah.
They might be able to be more circumspect about who they match with. Is that?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's the conjecture.
Okay.
Right? That's what sex workers have claimed. They have claimed that, you know, kind of obliquely, they basically usually say like the internet, but really what they mean is a series of platforms and tools that have emerged in equilibrium that manage their risk in their own opinion.
Okay.
And so Craigslist is just one of them. Right. And Craigslist was the first one that was very like impactful. So what Craigslist did, think about Think about it as like a giant Yellow Pages that just shows up at your house every day, you know, and it's got a giant list of every sex worker in the area, prices, sex acts, pictures, you know. So you have a bunch of things that happen. First of all, she doesn't have to work outside anymore. She doesn't have to work for an intermediary.
Yep.
Secondly, you have clients, many clients, like going back to that stigma thing, many clients, absolutely, there is no way in the world they would ever be seen driving in an area and picking up a prostitute. I mean, there's just no way for the marginal client, right? I mean, for the intramarginal, whatever, inframarginal, he'll do it. But like for the guy that at the margin who is deterred by stigma and risks of arrest, there's no way. And all of a sudden he's like, this seems clandestine. This seems like I'm not going to go anywhere, right? Like, I mean, she's going to come and meet me. I mean, I'm still worried, but I might feel like, you know, I can call her. I can talk to her on the phone. I can kind of feel this out. At the time, see, the erotic review was already in existence. So what's nice is that I had that erotic review data, and I can see what happens at the erotic review when Craigslist enters. Okay. And so what happens is that, I mean, it's really stark. There is a dramatic change in the composition of the sex workers at the erotic review. The number of women who work for agencies plummets. You can see it's visually incredible. Just goes from like, I don't know, 60, 70% of the reviews to like 45%. And they're all, and it's all growth in women that don't work for anyone. They're in the erotic review, there's a flag that says independent, and they're all independent sex workers. Meaning, what does that mean though? It means the client, in the client's opinion, they don't work for a pimp and they don't work for an agency.
Yeah.
Right. And that happens systematically when Craigslist enters, because Craigslist doesn't enter at one point in time. It rolls out to different cities at different points in time. There's about 40 different, I can't remember exact, I want to say it's dozens of different start dates across the country, groups of cities that get treated at different points in time. So you can see like this massive change. And what we can see is like in the data, best we can tell, the marginal sex worker appears to be a lower end sex worker. The reason I say that is because, now, I mean, you're an economist, so we can sort of talk about this a little bit, but you can see that when they enter, they're less attractive to these clients. They seem less professional, okay? So like when you think about like what this website was functioning for before, it was like agencies, professional sex workers. Craigslist was free. Craigslist was pulling, and if you know anything about the Craigslist ads, that it was pulling in women that were really like just off the street. That's the bulk of the advertisements. They were not like glamour photographed women, professional, high priced women. They were lower priced. They were lower wage workers. And that's what starts to happen at the erotic review. There's an influx of lower wage. Now it's shifting supply and demand, so I don't want to overstate that.
Yeah.
But you can sort of see evidence that of like negative selection, you know, or at least pulling from the lower, I don't want to say negative, lower wage workers entering the internet market. That's what I mean.
Those are the workers that might have been getting the worst deal from the intermediaries anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
That's so right. If you happen to be in a privileged spot in the market, then your motivation for going independent, so to speak, are going to be a lot lower.
Exactly. These men leave these long essays about the women. So it's like, you know, it's kind of got like, it's creepy, you know, it's a creepy website, right? But like they're leaving.
I have to think about it.
Yeah. But they leave all these essays. So we did all this like textual analysis on words. And one of the words we used was street, just simple word of the word street. And it's interesting. The word street actually systematically falls with the entry of Craigslist. You know, I mean, so it's kind of what I think it means is as Craigslist is rolling out, I mean, it's associated with a decline in people describing the women they're meeting as street workers.
Yeah.
So I have another paper with Todd Kendall that shows that, you know, as the erotic review grew, we used an IV strategy, instrumented with broadband, as it grew, the probability of a streetwalker arrest fell. So the larger part, I think, like, one of the things that the Craigslist paper shows, as well as my other work, is that one of the things the internet did is it took the women off the streets at the margin. It basically hollowed out the streets. That is echoed by sheriffs and police officers, and it's echoed by sex workers. But I think that me and Todd showed that, and I think that me and Greg and John Tripp have showed that too. What the Craigslist paper did, though, that me and Todd didn't do, is we then moved to safety, and we looked at female homicide rates. Because historically, before the internet, the modal, like street prostitutes had, street female prostitutes have the highest homicide rate for any type of work. I mean, you know, a lot of people would be like, well, it's not really work and they're not going to count it. But like, technically, if you count it as work, they have a homicide rate that's like 20 times higher than the next highest occupation homicide rate, which is a female liquor store employee. It's just ridiculous. It's the modal target of a serial killer is a female street prostitute. They have historically, you know, Jack the Ripper was targeted female prostitutes. So, you know, they have faced considerably high risks. And since we're finding that at least some of the growth in online is pulling in street prostitutes, given that these women and these men are able to communicate before, and the women can kind of feel out, you know, I mean, that's the thing about, the thing is, if it grows the market and it leads to more volume of transactions, right? And it allows her to, so she's got more demand, right? And if you think she just has to meet certain target incomes, she has the luxury to turn down clients, mm-hmm. right? For the first time, she does. Whereas when she's on the street, it's very spotty. She spends most of her day just standing there. A guy comes along, she can't screen him at all, yeah. right? You'll listen to these stories of these street prostitutes, and the things they do to screen the clients are ridiculous. They just use their eyesight, you know? They've never met this man before. And they'll ask if he's a cop. It's like stuff that won't work, right? There's all this folklore, right? And it's not like an oral tradition where all this wisdom gets passed down, because these women are really singletons. You know, they're not part of a community on the street. So it's not like all this embedded latent knowledge is getting in equilibrium, kind of passed through about what works. I mean, you know, they never see the guy that killed them, right? Yeah. And they're not mentoring. Once you're online, we can show with the erotic review the volume of transactions grows. You can also speak to women and say that their business improved because markets thickened, because search costs fell, and markets formed that weren't there before. So now they can turn men down and they can communicate with them before. They don't, with Craigslist, get the full battery of, like, you know, sophisticated tools, and many of these women don't use all the sophisticated tools, but it is at the margin and probably an improvement. And now you've just got, what's happening is, it's not that every one of these clients was wanting to hurt a woman, but it's like in equilibrium, if there's any risk that she can smell out, she's just able to sort in equilibrium to the lower risk people through just basic screening beforehand. So we find reductions in female homicide rates. And it's interesting because, you know, we go through all these robustness checks and we don't find reductions in male homicide rates. Where, you know, so it's like whatever's going on with Craigslist entry, it's just associated with the female homicide rate. It's not, you know, a generic crime thing. You know how these causal papers are. They're not randomized experiments. They're quasi experiments. Yep. They're vulnerable to lots of things. You know, it takes a lot of work to sort of provide convincing evidence, but it's the first paper to find any, it's the first paper, honestly, to even attempt to look at, you know, the effect of these technologies on the safety of women. To a high wage sex worker, she was never using Craigslist. So yeah. Some of those things weren't relevant. That's my point. It's like there's lots of variation in the sex workers. Those were not the women really facing the risk in the first place, because their counterfactual was really working with higher end agencies and stuff. It was for this marginal sex worker who free classified advertisement made a big deal.
Yeah. This is compelling and interesting. Let's shift and ask then the question that's probably on people's minds. If you take all of this into account and you're concerned about the welfare of these sex workers, then the question is legalization actually the thing that we should be doing? I've read enough of your writing to know that legalization can mean different things.
Yeah.
But if you were forced to write policy, or I should say if you were invited to write policy, what would you write?
Well, I'm not the only one. Me and Manisha Shaw have this paper studying the legalization of prostitution, indoor prostitution in Rhode Island. And we find that when indoor prostitution, meaning the owning of capital and transactions that occur indoors as opposed to street solicitation, when that was legalized, rapes went down and STDs went down. And we sort of have a story for it. There's another paper that looks at the legalization of street zones in Amsterdam. They also find rapes go down. There's a series of papers that have come out, and the pattern appears to be that if you can provide legal protections to the women, that seems to be the key. The key seems to be two things: legal protections, and like meaning the access to the courts and policing that will, allow for safer transactions, and indoor prostitution. It seems like, street prostitution has externalities. It's got nuisance externalities, like with, because it's public spaces and stuff, and because of the repugnance that people feel, just simply for that alone, it upsets a lot of neighbors. You can decide whether or not that should be counted, but like there is that part. But even apart from that, just that whole, if you can provide physical capital, then you have security cameras, you have bars on doors, you have a guy that works the front desk, you have many women that can work there, sort of have like eyes on each other. That if the goal is to reduce the violence against sex workers, if that is the goal, then I think there is arguments for legalization, right? Like, so, but see, that's not usually the goal. Like, the goal is that prostitution is intrinsically immoral and intrinsically like damaging to the women, even if they disagree. So like this all gets really complicated, because it's like a philosopher says that it, has some harmful effect on the woman, I guess, or the man, but the man and the woman are willing to enter into that voluntarily. So it's like, it's not obvious to me why his speculative opinion about the nature of that exchange dominates a woman who has no other economic options. She's got a family.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think my tendency is to say, look, I mean, there is a whole group of people who are doing it, and they do not have access to the courts. They're afraid to talk to the police because they'll be arrested. Clients know that. And so clients have improved bargaining power. They can't sue for battery, and they can't sue for failure to make payment. So it just begs for violence to occur in those markets. And I feel like I am a bit of a pragmatist, which is, I guess I say, sure, like in some kind of idealized general equilibrium, we could have a much different society along every margin, right? Like, I mean, just along margins of equality and everything could be very different in some sort of abstract sense. But in some sort of local kind of sense, I don't know if this criminalization is helping the women become their best selves, helping the men become their best selves, because the penalties for criminal sanctions are gigantic. Mm-hmm. And they follow a person through their whole life, and they shape everything. And they absolutely feed into inequality issues dramatically, right? And so many of these people, their next best alternative is horrible, right? I mean, it's like you just can't support a family as a barista at Starbucks. Like it's, and that's not even their next best alternative. They don't have, many of them do not have a, now they do not have a very good resume. They have these giant holes in their resume. They can't account for, it's very hard for them to enter the market. And so there's just this like practical ignorance amongst critics that I get frustrated by, because it's like, it just doesn't seem to speak into the realism of the situation. And the realism of like, when you say that this needs to be banned, many of these people are not in touch with the criminal justice literature and the repercussions practically of prison and arrest and inequality amongst that for minorities and all this stuff. It's just way too abstract and way too idealized for my taste. So I absolutely support decriminalization because for one reason, and that is because I just don't think you can have the infrastructure for creating safety for these women. Many people, they're just, the fact is many people are gonna have to make the hard moral choices about how to live their life and how to go through hard times, okay? And that's just gonna, that's just the hard work of being an adult. Being a moral adult is about making hard, difficult choices. And I'm not so sure that one is somehow this like catastrophic thing that we have to add all these penalties on top of just the moral difficulties of it, right? I mean, you could, the thing is like, there's lots of things coming from a Christian background, right? So now just going into a theological background, there are lots of things that I consider to be unethical that I don't believe you use the violence of the state to ruin a person's life to address, right? I mean, I just think many ways it's like, I just think like if I meet a person that is thinking about having an affair or something like that, I don't call the police, or that doesn't seem to me, or I don't have them hospitalized, or, you know, it's just simply like, it's just going to be the hard work of a relationship to talk to them about why they're doing that and why I agree or disagree. And it's just, to me, it's the same thing with a sex worker. I mean, it's just, I can't help but feel that there is a lot of inappropriate feelings that are deep, psychological, complicated things that are piggybacking on that repugnance. You know, just simply flat out disgust over sex and that this person is the other and they hate it.
All right, so this is an important challenge, I think. I think most Christians are going to come to the question of prostitution just assuming that it's immoral and therefore should be illegal.
Right.
Now I'd be the first to say that we can pull those two things apart.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, it strikes me that there are multiple different kinds of lines that we could draw. For instance, maybe we could get a critical mass of people that would agree to dramatically reduce the punishments for these kinds of crimes, but still retain the idea that something that is harmful for both participants, at least morally, if not physically,
right,
and could have severe complications and implications for the formation of families and, you know, right, marriages and whatnot. What would like a bipartisan consensus policy look like?
I mean, it's hard to say.
Other questions we could get into, but is there something that you could sell to the DNC platform?
I don't know. I mean, the problem is the tools that we have for what you're describing, they seem to always involve policemen.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the problem here is that, like, you know, in a secular society like the United States, the church is really not as influential of a mechanism. And that could have been, you know, so barring somebody from the Lord's Supper might be something that is a policy that was historically done to deal with things that fall short of, you know, true criminal sanctions. We don't feel like we want to use our scarce police resources in those ways, but we still want to nudge people, and we sort of have these, you know, things that are done, right? And so that might be something like, there's lots of stuff, right, that falls in that. But the problem is, that has no hope of working in the United States in 2020 because of how decentralized religion is, and there's no teeth on that. It's all self-selected voluntary relationships you have with the church in the first place. And if you choose to not recognize the authority of that, then it's a costless, right? And so the problem is, I don't think there is a mechanism to sort of communicate that this is inappropriate outside of criminal sanctions. You know, I mean, I guess like there's maybe things like, there could be things, see, like any idea that I come up with is going to de facto sanction it. You could think about licensing, right? Like you could think about things that have these quasi Pigouvian kind of solutions, right? Like, well, I'm going to tax them, right? So to do that, I've got to legalize it. Well, that automatically that kind of gets back to the original point, which is like, no, I don't want to endorse it though.
Yeah.
If you don't want it to exist, the only solution we have is the policeman. And that means guns and prisons.
Let's think a little bit about the long-term costs. So one of the things that if we were to legalize, so one of the things that worries me, and I'll say I come into this skeptical of legalization but at the same time, very intrigued by the empirical evidence that you've gathered. So my worry would be something like this. You have an app like Tinder. They just add payments on both sides. And pretty soon you have a kind of normalized payment for sexual encounters that becomes widespread enough, easy for all the reasons that you've mentioned, right? You can have technology facilitate these kinds of exchanges. And you could have the culture of casual sex become a culture of casual paid sex. It could be really large. I mean, you talk about market growth and the thickening of markets in some areas. How big does prostitution get in that future?
I don't know what those elasticities are. I mean, you know, and that's kind of what you're getting at is what exactly is the elasticity of demand with respect to stigma, right? If stigma was zero, completely zero, and search costs were zero, what is it? Probably it would grow considerably, especially amongst single people. And it would probably grow at the margin amongst married people, you know, for some marginal person. This is the quandary. Honestly, this is the quandary. It's you know, you see the same thing with abortion.
Yep.
It's the whole argument of like making it safe, right? So you make it safe, what happens? Demand is going to increase.
Yeah.
Right? You make it unsafe, demand decreases. But then at that infra margin, you have considerable risks and harms. It's the same thing with prostitution. If you make it safer, then demand will increase at the margin, as will supply, depending on what those elasticities are.
Yeah.
And I just don't think there's a free lunch on this. You know, I think that, you know, what we have right now is platforms that ban pornography, but clearly at least Apple's does. I don't know about the droids, but you don't have bans on Tinder, which are clearly hookup apps, right? So, you know, I think what would have to happen is it would just fall back on communities to communicate through those traditional channels the values of a higher tradition or a higher reality. I mean, I'm not sure. It's all going to come back down to what are the weights that we put on safety? What are the weights that we put on our confidence in keeping them from doing this thing is actually at the margin, ceteris paribus, good for their soul. Problem is, it's all ceteris paribus. So, you know, so like at the margin, keeping them from doing it is good for them. But in reality, what happens is it just like leads to this reorganizing of their life where it's not ceteris paribus because it's like it triggers so many things that the net welfare is ambiguous. Right. And that's like the realism of it is it's like even something as simple as they don't have insurance, they don't have health insurance, they can't access substance abuse insurance. Something about this psychologically I don't know if it's negative selection. I don't know if it's the stigma. I don't know what it is. They can't go to therapists. They can't access many mental health care treatments or substance abuse treatments. So if you really want to talk about policies that can help these sex workers, it really comes down to really like simple things like financial literacy and substance abuse policies that address that. Yeah. See, I mean, that's like, if you really want to get in and help women, you would provide, you would think really hard about tools that keep them from taking unnecessary risks, right?
Okay. How about just an expanded welfare state?
Yeah.
Some part of this discussion, at least, is that the underlying problem here is not just that some people have immoral preferences, but that we're in positions of extreme poverty.
Exactly.
With no other alternative.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, so there are plenty of countries that have more generous welfare states than the U.S. I mean, I'm writing right now about how I think the United States should expand healthcare to the point where we get close to universal coverage with basic insurance. And I'd be all for expanding housing vouchers and some other kinds of things. Right. Let's say we do expand the social safety net enough that someone having to make the choice between sex work and their kids going hungry just isn't a thing.
Right.
Does that have a big impact on supply?
I think so. I mean, I have this paper at Review of Economics of the Household with Todd Kendall that is this moonlighting model. And moonlighting is basically where you can only work up to X number of hours a week and then you have to take on a second job. But what's interesting about the model, and you would probably get it with just a canonical labor supply model, but you can sort of work through the comparative statics of what the effects of like income transfers are. And it's unambiguous in a lot of the dimensions that if you increase their outside income options, that there is at the margin reductions in both labor supply, theoretically, if the work is costly. It's kind of like built into the model that it's got these rising marginal costs to provide this work, which seems like, I mean, the most honest way of describing sex work, which is that it is psychologically costly, morally costly, and it's increasing in the number of, and the marginal costs are rising. You know, it's like it gets really, really physically taxing, and I think probably psychologically taxing, which is maybe why there's substance abuse problems. That's just a conjecture. When you can increase those outside options in terms of income, you know, they provide less, they enter the market less, and they provide less of the work. Now, it's not a huge stretch to think that that would also apply to a safety net, right?
Yeah.
Because in the discussions with sex workers, it is routine that they describe needing to meet monthly spending goals and having families or illnesses in the family. I mean, there's papers using sex workers in Kenya talking about when family members get sick, they'll start to engage in more higher risk sex behaviors, unprotected sex. Now, so you're seeing definitely in the literature a relationship between market income, market labor income, and the way that it's done in 2020 and the provision of this work. So the idea that you could eliminate some of that risk probably would address the marginal sex worker.
Yeah.
You know, it's the inframarginal sex worker, you know, she's probably... Many people want to do this. You know, that's the thing. The thing is, for some people, the costs are almost zero. You know, like the opportunity cost is really low. They enjoy the work or they have a lot of aesthetic, philosophical opinions about it, right? You see that, you see there's just a huge range of psychology around it. So like, you know, some of this stuff really is about the marginal sex worker, but I don't know about the modal sex worker exactly. And that's where you get back to policies that really are, if they're going to be there, we have to decide, and this is the Christian part of me, how do you love your neighbor that you don't necessarily agree with their choices, but ultimately they are internalizing those choices? How do you help them? You know, I personally believe, I don't think there are true externalities from sex work. I don't believe that being offended by another person counts in the moral calculus of the good society. So like, you know, I kind of discount that stuff. And then I just think more as a Christian, you know, what can I practically do to help somebody? And I see policy as like that. You know, there's some things that public policy is the only thing it can solve. I cannot, through my transfers of money, help most people in my city. You know, I mean, I'm going to need things from the state, from the city to provide true assistance to a lot of these people.
Hey, we've been talking for about an hour and there's two additional things that I wanted to ask you. So let's change topics here.
Sure.
Although I could go another half hour because I think I still disagree with you a little bit, but I'd probably be better off going and thinking about it for a year and coming back to you again.
Okay.
But I actually do want to give you a chance to talk about your textbook.
Oh, yeah.
So I've been following you online long enough that yeah. I got to watch you develop the causal inference textbook as you talked through it kind of publicly, which was really fun to watch. And then I was able to share it with a student a year or two ago, and he gained a lot from the free version.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's coming out from Yale, correct? Yeah. Can you talk okay. just real briefly, do some shameless promotion here. Give me the 2-minute pitch for why someone would be interested in this textbook.
So the book is useful for anybody that's who wants quantitative evidence that one thing caused another. You know, that's a very deep philosophical question that goes back millennium, you know, but like in the last 100 years, there's actually been a lot of practical breakthroughs in coming up with reasonable solutions to separating causal relationships from just simply coincidence. And so the book takes the reader through a lot of basic material, you know, basically takes them through the workhorse empirical model, ordinary least squares, as well as a lot of probability theory, and then goes through that philosophical notation that's the counterfactual theory of causality called potential outcomes, shows how this notation, which is really powerful and very easy to use, can help elucidate the kinds of questions we need to be asked. And then at that point, walks the reader through about five to seven, I don't remember exactly, like of those practical, you know, disciplines. You might call them like schools of thought or like designs or things like that, that are basically like situations that you can stumble upon where if the planets are aligned, you actually can use those situations in a certain way statistically to uncover a causal effect. And so the book has detailed descriptions of those research designs and goes through discussions of papers, a lot of history of thought, a lot of paper discussion, and then has programming examples with data sets that you can download from GitHub in both the programming language Stata, which is really popular amongst microeconomists, and then R, which is popular amongst microeconomists and the rest of the world. So, you know, you've got like the two programming languages. And so the book is really meant to really hold a person's hand, take them from I've never done anything to I've now worked through the book and I think I feel comfortable taking one of these things off the shelf and doing it myself. So that's the point of the book. You know, it's meant to be an empirical companion. It's meant to be a book that is in your bag, you know, that you pull out every now and then to kind of like, you know, look at. It is a textbook, but it's really more of what I've been thinking of it more as like, it's not like the first textbook in the econometrics class. It's like the supplemental textbook that gets assigned. So, and so, you know, it's targeted for economics, but it's also targeted for health, education, law, policy, and even data science and industry. It's really meant to be, you know, for everybody. Because I mean, a lot of these tools are extremely valuable for anybody in public policy and private policy. You know, so it's
true. And the kind of stuff that economists have been doing to try to pull apart causation, particularly with natural experiments and whatnot, it has been spreading into the other social sciences and certainly in epidemiology and other areas quite a bit. So I could see people in a lot of fields wanting to master this stuff.
Yeah.
If you were to pitch this in a curriculum, are you thinking like a second semester undergrad, first or second semester master's student? Or is this?
This class is two things. I think it's like, I think that causal inference is a class that can be taught at the upper level undergrad, even prior to econometrics. I actually, I think it can fit at the graduate level too. I mean, many of this material gets taught at the PhD level, usually like in the field courses, like labor and health and stuff.
Yeah.
But like pieces of it does get into your econometric sequence depending on the flavor of that professor. You know, even then he's probably not going to cover all of it. I'm of the opinion that we're not teaching econometrics optimally. I think a lot of students don't have the mental categories to understand what they are doing in econometrics. They can master it for the test,
yeah,
and still not understand deep, why are we doing this? What does it mean? The words causality may never even come up because econometrics really isn't causal inference. I mean, it's about identifying parameters, and those don't have to be expressed causally. What I believe is just pedagogically, first of all, my experience has been people are hungry for causality. First of all, I think that there's something about an undergraduate's progression of their critical thinking skills that they find that like one of the early philosophical ideas that they find really exciting, right? It's like, and the thing is, in the book, I have those philosophical ideas with the notation of potential outcomes and the graphical models, the directed acyclic graphical models. So it really taps into a hungry, curious student because so many of the designs use OLS. You actually only have to like the and or non-parametric stuff. It doesn't have to be as technical as those econometrics classes, because you don't have to do the proofs, you don't have to do all that stuff. They leave the course thinking causal inference.
Yeah.
And even if econometrics isn't causal inference, it's just a stool they can step on to finally make them engaged from the very first day of econometrics. I think that there is a missing class. Like, I think there's a missing prerequisite class, and it's not a calculus class. It's an inspiring class. It's a class that helps them think about maybe I could do research, yeah, right? Gets them into data, has them write programs, right? Has them download data and run regressions on something like that. I think when they do that, they are ready for econometrics. Now it does mean you have to stick something ahead of econometrics. And I don't think econometricians agree with me, but I completely believe it. Based on my experience with students.
And I could totally, I mean, I've struggled with our undergraduate econometrics curriculum. I taught it once, but we all agree that we're trying to do too much in one class, and students aren't coming away with the tools they need to then do their undergraduate research project if they're a good student. But I could see a two semester econometric sequence in which this was kind of lodged right in the middle.
Yeah.
Maybe Hope College someday will give me the bandwidth to add econometrics to our major. We'll see.
The thing is about causal inference too is like, if econometrics is not the prerequisite, then you could sell it more broadly to non-econ majors, you know. But, and so I think you could fill those classes by tapping in and providing that service for other disciplines, even in the humanities. I mean, I think more people need it. Like at Baylor, for instance, we have, and I think it's probably like this at Hope too, the new generation of students seem far, far more dialed into social justice issues while still being evangelicals, for instance. So it's like, you know, whereas I think in my generation, those were like separate spheres. I don't think that's the case anymore. And so like, I've had students that want to go work for anti-trafficking organizations, for instance. They need this. Yeah. Right? Because like, they're not going to get far in any of those organizations if they don't have these technical skills, but none of them want to major in economics, you know? And so just having some knowledge about program evaluation and some comfort level with a spreadsheet and a programming language, I just think goes along. Like, I think this does go somewhere at the margin. So I'm working with, and so we need to talk more about this later. I'm working with, is it Westmont College?
Westmont is a college.
Yeah, Westmont Christian College. Yep. I'm working with Bruce Wittick at University of San Francisco. He's starting like a center that will do a standalone certificate that's like, you know, connected with Westmont, Baylor, Wheaton. We should talk too, and I need to introduce you to Bruce, and maybe Hope could be involved.
Believe it or not, I've met Bruce, and I've already interviewed him for this podcast. So our readers will probably have heard, our listeners probably will have heard his voice before yours when this all goes live.
Yeah. I mean, I think there needs to be in the Christian education community a significant tackling of training people with empirical skills. Because, and the reason is, if only because effective charity requires it.
Yep.
You know, and I think like, but yeah, so causal inference is kind of, I think, a really great way to it could be that, like, part of that program.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a hard sell with me, definitely. And I've seen the material and I like it. I'll put a link in the show notes. Anyone who's listening to this can see the link over at Yale University Press, which has already got a page for it. If memory serves, it's not going to be available for sale until January. Yeah. Or something of the sort. We'll watch that. Let me finish this up with a question I'm trying to ask everybody. And it's a broad question that's kind of animated the Association of Christian Economists for some time. And it's animated us because we don't agree, all right? And the question broadly is, just how do you think about being a Christian and an economist? How are the two connected, right? Does Christianity impact the way you do economics or the kinds of questions? Or is it largely separate?
I don't know. Everybody answers that differently, I think. I mean, I think that what it's meant to me is my Christian journey, you know, has evolved over time. And whereas I once was really so Beckerian, kind of in like the economic way of thinking, I think my private Christian ethos has made me very concerned about inequality and racial inequality in the criminal justice system. It's made me very concerned about mental health care and the caring of the least fortunate. And so what I've noticed is I'm just increasingly choosing projects that I think I can, I mean, I am ultimately a scarce resource because I am an economist. So I am working on projects that mean a lot to me, that mean a lot to me, and I am a Christian. And so, you know, they mean a lot to me. So a lot of my new work is on mental health care, the mental health courts, the treatment of PTSD. And that's driven by what I believe is a real genuine understanding that Jesus really cares about the well-being of these people. And we have to figure out how to organize our scarce resources to get them care, you know, and not do things that don't work, right? Because those are a waste of money. That could be, and then we might have to. So I think that I'm still fundamentally an applied microeconomist doing program evaluation, but my thing is I care more and more about helping people, and I care about inequality and I care about poverty. So for me, that's like, it's a real simple connection. You know, I think like early on, probably like I was reading a lot of writers that were doing like Christian economics more explicitly because I had that philosophical background, you know, and I was like really intrigued by this kind of discussion. And I just sorted into a different job. You know, I sorted into applied micro, empirical work, teaching. I think like the other thing is part of my understanding of my Christian obligations are to these students, you know, the ones at Baylor, get them jobs, care about their training, teach classes that actually will benefit them. And also, honestly, I mean, giving the mixtape away and doing free workshops and things and providing public goods for the AEA, that's also been a part of my Christian interpretation of discipleship, which is, you know, I really believe there are a lot of lonely people in economics, and I want them to feel known, and I want them to know other people. And that's why I provided that 5K that I do every year at the AEA. It's just, you know, you have to figure out in your discipleship what is not being provided that you uniquely are fitted to do. And if you're willing to think outside the box and think and reflect on your comparative advantages, yeah, I mean, it's a great job. So you can do whatever you want to do. You can do this podcast, you can do a 5K. And in many ways, that's my way of also providing healing at the margin for people, building community. That's a big deal to me.
I like it. I think that's a fine place to end. So thank you so much, Scott. This has been a great conversation. Where can people find out more about you if they were intrigued?
I update at my website, my papers. I'm going to be posting a series of lectures for causal inference at YouTube. So that'll be posted on my website also. So if you want a free causal inference class, like a Coursera class, I'm going to be posting, you know, 12 hours of lectures. So that'll be up there soon too.
All right. Well, when this thing goes live, I'll make sure that there's links to all the relevant Scott Cunningham stuff on the page and people can go find it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Stephen. It was good talking to you.
That is our show for today. Again, I am Stephen McMullen of Hope College and editor of the journal Faith and Economics. If you have any comments or questions, I would love to hear from you. You can always email me at podcast@christianeconomist.org. Remember to subscribe or follow us so you can see new episodes as we release them, and to rate us on Apple Podcasts so that other people can find this show. For those interested in supporting the show, we welcome monetary donations. Just go to anchor.fm/faithfuleconomy and click on the button that says support. 100% of donations go toward the programming of the Association of Christian Economists. No one associated with ACE is paid a dime, and donations are all tax deductible. Faithful Economy is a program of the Association of Christian Economists and the journal Faith and Economics. You can find out more about the association and the journal at christianeconomists.org, and you can follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn.